Hi, it's Patrick Cox. And if I say the Hamptons to you, what do you think? What do you see in your mind's eye? For me, it's the super rich. Mansions, golf clubs, that kind of thing. Among the many things I don't see in this picture are Native Americans. But there is a tribe there.
We live on Long Island, which is like very removed from what a lot of people think of as Native America, which, you know, Navajo, Minnesota, South Dakota, there are great populations of Natives up there. Being so isolated, that has had a great impact on our identity.
An impact, too, on the language they used to speak, a language they're attempting to revive. You'd have to say the chance of bringing this dormant language back is pretty small.
It is small in comparison to other tribes that have fluent speakers, that have written languages, that have apps that you can, you know, just reference. That's not something that we have yet.
But what else can this group of people do? The language is their culture encoded.
The hardest thing is to feel like you don't know your own culture.
The Shinnecock of Long Island today, after this.
The world in words is made possible in parts by the National Endowment for the Humanities, celebrating 50 years of excellence.
Also in today's pod, David Bowie and the word they. First, though, it's the Shinnecock and their language. And this is the first of what we hope is going to be a series of podcast episodes on people who are trying to revive languages, whether it's raising a language from the dead, a language that is no longer spoken, or at the other end of the spectrum, a language that's spoken by a ton of people, but for one reason or another, there's fear for its future. Along the way, we want to ask some questions, some awkward questions, like, is it worth it? Is the language that's being revived of real value to the people who speak it? Is it a mark of cultural identity that can't be replaced? Is the world an alien place if you take away that language? Also, is the effort worth it? It's a huge effort. If you throw your energy into language revival, it means that you may be overlooking something your community may need more, like prosperity or jobs, land. And then, what's the role of outsiders in pumping oxygen into a language, non-native speakers? In the old days, that might have been the Bible translators, even if they didn't realize quite what they were doing. Nowadays, it may be linguists or other language activists. What right do they have to possibly tamper with the language? And then, if you pass all of those smell tests, this question. In reviving a language, you may feel you have to simplify it. Languages that are spoken by relatively few people in relative isolation tend to be grammatically complex. The more widely the language is spoken, the simpler it's likely to become over time. It may lose some of its grammatical idiosyncrasies and fit in more with the larger languages around it and borrow words from those languages too. So the question is, where's the line? When does a language lose its unique attributes and become no longer worth saving? Do the speakers of the language need to protect its uniqueness? And if so, how the hell do they do that? Now, these may all be questions for members of the Shinnecock tribe in years to come, but not yet. Right now, they just want to learn anything about their language. Or maybe it's just a dialect. We don't even know that. Not much at all is known about Shinnecock, except that it belongs to the Eastern Algonquin language family. It's not an exaggeration to say that the Shinnecock people feel alienated from what was once their native tongue. But then again, just about every circumstance of the Shinnecock situation screams alienation. All of which made Alina Simone want to visit a preschool the tribe has built and recently opened.
Walk into the Wunichanuk preschool on a typical weekday morning, and you'll be greeted by the smell of burning sage and words unheard anywhere else in the world. Children singing in the Shinnecock language. Yes, this is the only Shinnecock reservation, and it's a small one of around 650 people. But the reason the sound of Shinnecock being spoken is so unusual is that there are no fluent speakers of Shinnecock left, haven't been for more than a century. With New York City only an hour and a half drive west, the pressure to assimilate has always been intense for the Native Americans of Long Island.
It didn't seem like a reasonable thing to spend their time and effort on for their children if it wasn't going to be helpful for their future.
This is Tina Tarrant, the tribe's language researcher.
And people don't imagine that your language is going to disappear entirely. That's like such a strange concept that people don't think of it.
But a few years ago, Tina came up with an even stranger concept, bringing that vanished language back.
Well, I just always wondered why people weren't saying more things in our language. Because we always talked about culture, we always made things and did the songs and the dances. And we didn't use our own words to describe what it was we were doing. So I started looking for the words.
As a child, she collected those words like baseball cards.
Common phrases, nicknames from what my grandmother was called by her grandparents, and, you know, little bits and pieces.
So when she had her own child, it made sense to give her a Shinnecock name.
Tohonish. She's named after a hawk who flew by my cousin's house, my mother's house, and my house the morning that she was born.
That was in the 1980s. Hardly anyone on the reservation had a Shinnecock name back then. Tohonish is now 31.
My generation is the first generation in probably three generations to have Algonquin names. It was something that my mom made sure that all six children had names in Shinnecock.
Tina's decision was personal, but it was also strategic.
The reason for putting these unusual names in the, you know, local community was so that our words would continue to be spoken and they would have a firm understanding of at least one or two words in our language, even if it were their own names.
It worked. Soon, other tribe members were asking questions about Shinnecock words, wanting to give their children native names too. Tina saw hope for a larger revival of the language and organized some workshops on the reservation. But the challenges were intense. Aside from a handful of surviving word lists, there was only one written source for the Shinnecock language, a Bible translated by a native man, Kokono de Long Island, in the mid-1600s. Tina had no institutional support, no money, not even a college degree. It took years of effort to track the Bible down, on microfiche from a library in Scotland, of all places. The tribe itself was too busy fighting a protracted battle for federal recognition to make language revival a priority. You'd think being surrounded by the uber-wealthy would give the Shinnecock an advantage over other tribes. Not the case.
Now, for the New York elite, summertime generally means one thing, and that is decamping to the Hamptons, the holiday spot for the rich and famous in America.
Towering hedges stretch down Southampton streets for miles, obscuring the multi-million-dollar homes of celebrities like Rachel Ray and Howard Stern. But unless you count lending their name to one of the world's most exclusive golf clubs, the Shinnecock don't share in that wealth. In a place where the average house sells for almost $2 million, the average Shinnecock family makes barely $14,000 a year. And Tohonish says that's not the only drawback to being an urban East Coast tribe.
There are a lot of issues relating to the land, relating to sales of the land or leases that were never made good on. So we lost a lot of territory. And that has always been a challenge for us because here we are, a small Native American community in the middle of the home of millionaires. So here we have to take these millionaires to court over our land. It's kind of really an uphill battle for us.
But in 2010, Tina's scholarly goals dovetailed with the tribe's judicial ones when the Shinnecock became the 565th tribe to be recognized by the federal government. 2 years later, the tribe voted to build a new preschool, and a radical concept was floated to incorporate Shinnecock language into the curriculum. The school opened its doors this past summer with Tohonish as its manager. It was up to a team of seven people, Tohonish, her mother, and five teachers, to figure out how to bring Shinnecock back to life.
Hakameya is welcome. But then there was another, somebody else said it the other day to me, and I was like, huh? Hakameya? Hakameya?
Everybody was kind of in their beginning stages of learning of a language. And we had to we had to work with everybody on their different levels. So we started with simple words that can be used in the classroom. We started with translating songs, popular songs, such as Twinkle Twinkle Little Star.
Up above, okay, so high, like a barbecue in the sky.
Tahanish has since left her job at the school, but the language program continues. Clearly, there's a long way to go before kids are watching Dora the Explorer or thumbing through apps in Shinnecock. But people are starting to use native words around the reservation, beyond just, hey, Tahanish. Simple things like
Muskanawash and Waninakone and, you know, Wanimotapan. They're all words for, like, good morning, good evening. It's very interesting how it's like people are owning it. They're owning their identity by just seeing these words on a regular basis and starting to use them with each other.
It's a big change from when Tina first launched her effort to reintroduce Shinnecock back in the 80s.
The hardest thing is to feel like you don't know your own culture.
Looking back at all the challenges to breathing life into the Shinnecock language, this hurdle, the psychological barrier, may have been the biggest one.
This is all a part of our identity, and it's not something that we all grew up with. So to put that, you know, bad feeling aside, that this is not something that I know, it's something that you can learn. It's okay that we weren't taught this growing up. This is something that we're bringing back, and we need to embrace.
Owning your identity, even in the Hamptons, you can't put a price on that.
Alina Simone is a regular on this podcast. She's based in New York. And it would be good to check in on this fledgling attempt at language revival in a few years' time. Talk to some of the graduates of the preschool and their teachers, who sound like they're teaching themselves along the way. How much will they have learned, for example, about the grammar of Shinnecock? Is it sufficiently similar to related languages up and down the East Coast? Will that help them? It'll be good to find out further on down the line, and more soon in this podcast on the language revival front in some other part of the world. We've got stories lined up from other parts of North America, as well as Asia, Africa, and Europe. It is happening in various ways, in various guises, all over the map. So, a couple of events took place this past week within, as far as we know, roughly 48 hours of each other. Totally unrelated events. The first was at the annual meeting of the American Dialect Society. Every year, as you may know, their members, linguists, lexicographers, those kinds of people, they vote for a word of the year. And this year's word, or rather the word of 2015, was they. Yes, that simple pronoun that's been around for quite a while. Plural pronoun, occasionally used as a singular. What's new about it in 2015 is that it's become the go-to singular pronoun to describe a person in a gender-neutral way. Even the Washington Post now allows it. The second event was the death of David Bowie. I have to say that this meant an awful lot more to me, as it did to many millions of others, than the Word of the Year announcement. I'm not one to grieve the passing of people I don't know, but I do find myself grieving Bowie's passing. And I think there is a connection, maybe a tenuous one, with that word they. And for some reason, it was one of the first things that struck me after hearing both pieces of news. David Bowie, futurist that he was playing around with they many decades ago. Back in the early 70s, he declared he was gay, just about the same time that he announced that he and his wife were having a kid. He cross-dressed. Or rather, he dressed to confuse people about his gender. So on Facebook, along with that famous video of him performing Starman on British TV, I posted this. Back in the last century, this multicolored vision of lycra and eyeshadow appeared on our dull TV sets in our brown living rooms. He gave many of us confused kids permission to experiment with gender and identity. Thank you, David Bowie, for pioneering they androgyny. Now, I'm sure that this pioneering of they androgyny and all of that, it wasn't intended on Bowie's part. He wasn't a crusader of those kinds of ideas or political positions or anything like that. I think he just wanted to jolt people into thinking differently. Jolt himself, too, by assuming all of these different personas. Here he is in 1973.
I find that I'm a person who can take on the guises of different people that I meet. I can switch accents in seconds of meeting somebody and I can adopt their accent. I've always found that I collect. I'm a collector. And I've always just seemed to collect personalities, ideas. I have a hodgepodge philosophy, which really is very minimal.
Very minimal, very effective. And through all his guises and his love of accents and artifice, he stuck to that philosophy. And he sang about the same stuff all his life. He said so. Fear and alienation. Must have been touching close to 94. Oh, but I'm always crashing in the same car. I don't know if you heard the interview Bowie did in 2002 with Terry Gross. They replayed it on Fresh Air this week. Well, that interview was great on the subject of the past, the Ziggy Stardust time and all of that. But there's another long, in-depth interview he did around about the same time. He was promoting a lesser-known album of his back in 2002 called Heathen. And this interview is with the BBC. He talks more about the present and the future. Here's a bit from it where he's talking about aging and writing.
There are occasions when I really don't want to write that. It just seems that I have a physical need to do it. In fact, there's an instance of that on the song Heathen. I realised the words were literally tumbling out for it. I was very alone, very isolated, up in the studio one early, as is my wont, at 5 o'clock or 6 o'clock in the morning. I was up in the studio on my own waiting for everybody else to get up. And I was kind of putting the day's work together, and this thing started appearing for me. I'd already written a melody that I very much liked, and the words started appearing out of nowhere, and I just couldn't control them. And I realised what it was that it was about, and I was in tears by the end of the thing. It was really, I'm not sure if it was... it was a traumatic moment for me, at least. Possibly it was an epiphany, I don't know. I have to go and look at Epiphany in the dictionary and see if it was an epiphany. I think it was a traumatic epiphany. Steal on the skyline.
Sky made of glass.
It's a man confronting the realization that life is a finite thing and that he can already feel it. Life itself actually going from him, ebbing out of him, the weakening of age. And I didn't want to write that. You know, I didn't want to know that I do feel that. Who does? Waiting for something. Looking for someone. It's not the age itself, you know. I mean, age doesn't bother me. I really, so many of my heroes were older guys. It's the lack of years left that weighs far heavier on me than the age that I am. I feel pretty good, frankly. And I do what I've always wanted to do. I'm a writer. But yet it's having to let go of it all, you know. Even more so now, it's so much more poignant. There's such a... for me, often there's such a cloud of melancholia about knowing I'm going to have to leave my daughter on her own at a, you know, I don't know what age that's going to be, thank God. But it just doubles me up in kind of grief.
A I'll post a few links, that BBC interview, a couple of other Bowie interviews, also the website of Lavinia Greenlaw. She's a poet, and she's done a kind of instant poetic appreciation called Listening to Bowie. That'll be the last thing you hear in this podcast. All of those links, and more on the Shinnecock, including a bunch of photos from their preschool, all of that is at pri.org/language. One favor to ask, please write us a review at iTunes or wherever you get this podcast. It really helps. You can tweet me at Patrick Cox, that's PatriCox, or the podcast at LingoPod. And why don't you try again to guess the accent of the woman reading our funding credit? I know that in the last podcast, Nina promised you the answer this week. And I really was going to give you the answer and give you a new accent to try to guess. But, you know, I got bowied. So we're going to run this one more time. Where is the speaker from? And bonus points if you can guess the region within the country. Thanks for listening. See you next time.
The world in words is made possible in part by the National Endowment for the Humanities, celebrating 50 years of excellence.
I'm a girl who looks like a boy who looks like a girl, and everything is going to be all right. The one I will love when I'm old enough to love is waiting for me out there on the street among the puddles and cardboard boxes, wearing emerald lurex and a gold crest. His attributes, including his boyness, will be reversible, and I will learn that mine are too. One of these is that he has several voices. He sounds like loose straw, or a bowl of water overturning in a bowl of water, or a mountain king. He has the ability to detach himself from himself in order to reform. He will teach me to offer something to look at in order not to be seen, that in order to be heard, I must not repeat myself. He will always be leaving, walking backwards, and singing even after the door is closed. He's gone. Exiled to the flat fields, we can dance to this. We can perfect our routine.
Soundworks.
Soundworks.
From PRI.